All right, welcome to the Free Stretch Week 2 edition here on JoeBucksFan.com. I'm Bobby Fenton. We are, in fact, talking about a 1-0 football team as the Bucks go into Minnesota on the opening Sunday of the season and get a 20-17. Just gutsy. You hear that word, it's cliche, gritty, all that stuff, but that was a gutsy, gritty win that I will be perfectly honest with you, I did not think they were going to get as I was watching the fourth quarter of that game. I certainly didn't think they were going to get it as I was watching the first two quarters of the game, but even in the fourth quarter, it just felt like, they're not going to be able to get this done, and they just showed guts and grit and playmaking ability and did what they had to do, and they come away from Minnesota, a tough road environment, in a situation where, like I told you on last week's show, if you weren't a Bucks fan, you were just looking at things objectively, that might even be one of the teams you'd consider in one of those survivor pools, taking Minnesota to beat the Bucks, and they get it done, and they come home this weekend for the home opener at Raymond James Stadium, a 1 o'clock kickoff on Sunday. The Chicago Bears, who were thumped at home against Green Bay, come into town. It's a good chance for the Bucks to go 2-0. Nothing is taken for granted, but we will talk about all of it today on the show. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to the Joes for giving me the platform and allowing me to be on the single best place for Bucks coverage anywhere, TV, internet, radio. It's Joe Bucks Fan. First things first, if you want to get a hold of me, always easy to do. Love getting your emails. You can email me bobbygameday@yahoo.com. That's BOBBYGAMEDAY, bobbygameday@yahoo.com. Also on Twitter, same thing. Follow me at bobbygameday. And you'll be subject to many different thoughts, comments, questions, caution, discussion, all the things you get there, and you can check it out. So, want to look ahead to Bucks-Bears, of course, but, it's been a few days removed now, so I don't want to spend too much time looking back, but we need to look back a little bit about what they did on Sunday, because that was a really big win, and I don't know what's going to happen this season. I'm still, I don't know if I've changed my outlook on the whole season just based on week one, where I told you before that there's a span of records that wouldn't surprise me that go it goes all the way basically from 4-13 all the way to 9-8. Anything in that range wouldn't surprise me. I guess now, having watched that, I'd be a little surprised at 4-13 or even 5-12. I could still see anywhere from 6-9 wins, something like that. And I still have a hard time believing this is a 10-win plus team, but I could be wrong. And let me tell you, I was wrong, or maybe I wasn't, but seemingly wrong. Because I'm watching the first half of the game, I'm watching the offense just absolutely anemic. Just literally no chance of anything happening at all. And they're going 0 for the universe on third down. They're not moving the ball down the field. I was getting really frustrated because I'm watching, and even when they're throwing the football, and they couldn't run the ball at all, but I'm watching, even when they're throwing the football, everything's to, the flat, the side, quick hit, dink, dink, dink. I've said it before, I'll continue to say it. It's not me saying it, it's just true. I'm not some guru, but if you're going to be a successful team, if you're going to be a successful offense, you have to be able to get the ball down the field, period. And Minnesota was doing it in the first half, and then the turnovers were the big difference, and then the turnovers cannot be discounted because Minnesota was getting the ball down the field. Justin Jefferson had, 7 catches for 138 yards in the first half. That would only end up being 2 for 12 in the second. But they were getting the ball down the field. They were moving. And you can't do it any other way. You have to throw the ball vertically. And I don't mean deep balls. I mean those 10, 15, 20-yard routes over the middle of the field, to the sideline, whatever. Not just launching deep balls. They tried one to Mike Evans. He only had the one target. They missed a big one to Coe Keith. That would have been a big play at the time in the red zone. Couldn't hit him. Baker Mayfield missed it high. But other than that, they weren't even, nothing downfield. Nothing. And I was getting frustrated. And I was already starting to think about, I'm a fan just like you. I always say this. I'm not just a guy who used to host a radio talk show. I'm not a journalist. I'm a fan who has been lucky enough to, at certain times, to have a microphone. But I still have the natural fan reactions. I still overreact sometimes. I'm still quick to say things. I don't always say things I don't mean, but I'm quick to say things that maybe I should have waited to say, or maybe there isn't enough information. I do all those things too, just like you guys do, or some of you guys. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But I'm watching the game on Sunday, and I tweeted, this is sometime in the second quarter, If you think the answer to the offense's issues is that they need to run the ball more or better, it's the ability to get the ball down the field that produces the results we want. Good offenses pursue and accumulate points efficiently and aggressively. This offense can't. And everything I said there is true except for the last three words. This offense can't. That's still maybe true. I'm not going to say I was wrong yet. They certainly got better in the second half, although their overall offensive output was still not that much. But they got it done is the main thing, and that's what we all care about. I'm still concerned about this offense's ability on a weekly basis to do what it needs to do to be a high-level team. And I mean, when I say concern, maybe that's not the word, because what do you think or hope the Bucks could be? We talked about it all week on the all show last week on the show. If you want to be one of those top teams, and I'm talking about like not just a team that kind of stays in it, keeps it entertaining, that I think the Bucks can definitely be. But if you want to think of your team as an actual true contender, and maybe we don't, I'm not sure I do. But you saw what happened to the Bucks in 2020 and 2021. Like, that's how it has to look if you're going to be anywhere near where you need to be. And you saw the Bucks offense last year, and that's what it looks like for most of the teams in the NFL. And that's why there's only a handful of elite. That's why they're called elite. So I'm not doing a total 180 here and saying, hey, now the Bucks are Super Bowl contenders. But you need to be able to move the football in chunks. And even though the third down conversions were bad, certainly that was bad. You know, 0 for 5, 6, 7, whatever it was in the first half. But the best offenses don't just pick up their third downs. They don't have manageable third downs. They get big chunks of yardage on first and second down, and they keep the sticks moving without even facing third down. Like, people think, oh, they got to be really good on third down to stay on the field. It's certainly a good thing. It helps. But the best offenses just get tons of yards all the time. They just move the ball. And so, we'll see if the Bucks offense can do that. It got a lot better in the second half. Now, I'm not even sure how to react to this news, but now we got the news today that Baker Mayfield had picked up on the Vikings' defensive signals. And so they knew the coverages. They were able to pick up like what they were running and things like that on defense, which is cool, I guess. But now I'm kind of thinking, we literally can't run a competent offense unless we have the other team's signals. Is that what this is? And I'm not saying that's what it is, but that didn't make me feel like better or anything. I was like, that explains why we couldn't whiz a drop for the first almost 30 minutes. And then after that, it got a lot better. But I'll tell you what did make a difference, because I said almost 30 minutes. It was the final drive before half where the offense kind of picked up. And you know why? Because they had to go fast. It was a two-minute drill. They didn't have that much time. And I've said this over and over. I know I sound like the middle-aged guy at the sports bar, but it really does benefit teams, especially teams that don't have high-flying offenses, to act like they really need to score quickly even when they don't. Because you saw the Bucks offense finally figure things out, and when did that happen? When they had to go tempo. They didn't have time to do all that. Just boom, let's go. They started moving the ball down the field. They started getting more aggressive, and it led to a huge drive. The points before the half are a huge thing. I mean, they're a huge thing in football. And the Bucs scored a huge touchdown right before the half. And not only did they do that, but then when Minnesota took their turn trying to get their points before the half, Christian Eisen made an incredible play, a strip interception at the goal line, and put up a big zero for Minnesota. Then the Bucs got the ball back in the second half to start things out and scored again. You win those middle, they call it the middle 8 minutes or whatever, middle 6 minutes, the final 4 minutes or 3 minutes of the first half and the first 3 or 4 minutes of the second half. You win those minutes in a big way like the Bucs did, that goes a long way. And it's, obviously they needed every single point they could get. And the turnovers on top of that were huge. They got a lucky one when Minnesota was moving the ball really well and messed up a snap. But the Eisen pick was awesome. That was a great play by him. By the way, he is right now, he was in a no-contact jersey at practice today. Today's Thursday as I record this. And in the concussion, protocol type thing, so we'll see. He was out there though, so that was good. We'll get to more about the injury report and the Bucks Bears in a minute, but that was a big drive to close the first half out. And from there, the Bucks offense got a lot better, and like I said, they just made gutsy plays. And let's stop right here and say one other thing, because I'm very critical of Todd Bowles at times, and I don't ever want to be one of those guys that's only critical but then doesn't say anything when it's the other way around. And Todd Bowles had a hell of a game Sunday, both as the de facto defensive coordinator calling the defense. Like I said, they got kind of lit up a little bit in the first half, and he made the adjustment, and the Minnesota offense did not do a thing in the second half. So there was that, but then as the head coach and his decision, his fourth down decisions, his game management decisions, which we've been critical of, and we are for a lot of coaches, not just Todd Bowles, but they were spot on. His fourth down, first of all, fourth and one, game's tied, 8 minutes and change to go. Bucks are on their own, like 32-yard line, fourth and one in a tie game. And Minnesota's offense, you hadn't been doing much, but you felt like it was only a matter of time. Didn't want to give him the ball back there. The Bucks thought they had the first down on third and short. They didn't. They challenged the spot, and it wasn't overturned, so they had a fourth and short. And it's a no-brainer. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it was some masterful thing. It's a no-brainer that you go for that, but a lot of coaches, even with that being a no-brainer, would not have gone for it. So to see Todd Bowles not hesitate, go for it. Baker Mayfield gets it, keeps the drive going. That was the drive that would eventually lead to the 57-yard field goal by Chase McLaughlin. And that's another one where, you know, it was fourth and three or whatever it was. I'm thinking, well, at first they showed, like, you know, people just running on and off the field. So I couldn't tell what it was on the broadcast. I thought it was the punt team. And I was ready to completely flip and lose my shit and come onto Twitter and start ranting. And then they said, oh, no, it's the field goal team. Okay, hey, that's better than punting there. You know, I was thinking go for it, but they go for the 57-yard field goal. He knows his kicker. I don't have a problem with that. And even if he had missed it, I wouldn't have had a problem as much as if they would have punted. But McLaughlin just drills it. I mean, just, you know, these guys today are amazing. Like, in the NFL, if you grew up when I did, like in the 80s and 90s, the kicker was some little foreign guy with a soccer background who didn't know anything about football, and they were like 2 of 7 from 40 yards and more. And now guys hit 57-yarders, like the ball is still going up when it hits the net. It's like an extra point, it looks like. They can just absolutely hit nukes. And still, I don't even in today's modern-day NFL, a 57-yard field goal is not something that is high percentage or anything like that. But you know your kicker, and Todd Bowles knew his kicker, thought that was the best move. He hits what ends up being the game-winning field goal. And then even after that, when the Bucks got the ball back again, after Minnesota failed to score on the ensuing drive, Bucks are trying to salt the game away. Third and 10, that's another one where I was surprised, and a lot of coaches would have done this, just hand the ball off or run some really conservative play or a short pass beneath the sticks where you're just hoping maybe they run for it, but you don't really care that much. You just don't want something bad to happen. I did not think the Bucks were going to get aggressive and go for the stick on third and 10 there, which, again, they should have. It was the right thing to do. But a lot of coaches, including what I thought would be Todd Bowles, would not normally do that. They would play it conservative. Bucks got aggressive, went for the first down, ran the route past the stick. And by the way, what the hell was the Minnesota cornerback doing on that play? Like, it's third and 10. You lose if they get the first down. They're playing off coverage, which I get that part. But then as Godwin is in the stem of his route, like, bursting up the field, the corner just backpedals with him. Like, he gives up the stick, basically. Just says, here, take the stick. And Godwin took the stick. And it wasn't even anywhere near him. Like, it was just a throw and catch. And it wasn't easy. It was a good throw, but an even better catch. And Godwin double-clutched it, stayed in bounds. And I'm sitting here at home thinking, wow, like I literally would have bet against every single one of the things that have happened in the past 30 minutes happening, and they all happen, and the Bucks get a really big win. The offensive line, let's talk about that for a minute, because that was a concern. Tristan Wirfs looked no problem at all at left tackle, judging by everything I saw, and then, you know, other people who broke it down on Twitter and some of these offensive line play guys, and they broke down and he was good, and PFF agreed. And some people don't like Pro Football Focus or their grades, but just to give you an idea, the 5 highest and lowest rated Bucks on offense and defense per PFF. On offense, Baker Mayfield was the highest, followed by Tristan Wirfs. Matt Filer, the guard next to Wirfs, the left side of the line was good. And then Wells, somehow, 74.1. Rashad White was 5th. I'm not sure what he did to get to be the 5th highest offensive player. The lowest rated ones, Cade Otton, Robert Hainsey, Cody Mauch, So basically, the left side of the line was really good. The right side of the line, not as good. And Hainsey at center, not as good. Although Gedeky wasn't bad. He wasn't top or bottom five. If you're curious on defense, highest rated players on defense, Devin White, Vita Vea. I think Shaq Barrett's up there. Lowest was Antoine Winfield, which may surprise you. He got huge marks for his run tackling and his pass rush, but a lot of his coverage grade was coverage snaps because that was two-thirds of his grade, and he wasn't as good in coverage, but still pretty good. Jamel Dean up there. Ryan Neal actually up there too. Down there, I should say. These are the lowest rated guys. Jamel Dean down there, Ryan Neal. But Levante David, Devin White, really good games on defense to go along with Shaq Barrett. And then offensively, like I said, the offensive line. Look, if we get that level of play from the offensive line, and hopefully Hainsey and Cody Mauch making his first NFL start with like a back tweak, so I'm not going to jump on him too much, but that can improve a little bit. The Bucs will be okay. Like, you can do a lot worse than what you saw on Sunday. Believe me, we've seen it. And so, overall, just pretty good. Like, and just, you know, the team looked well coached. 3 penalties, 19 yards, no turnovers, like stuff like that. Todd Bowles called a hell of a game and made really good decisions, and the Bucs delivered and made plays. Baker Mayfield picking up a big third down to go with that 4th-and-1 conversion where he stiff-armed the DB and then trash-talked him. And, you know, looking back now, it seems quaint, and this isn't to dump on Kyle Trask or anything, because the Bucs might have won if Kyle Trask had played too. But remember when Ira the Sage, you know, said, hey, folks, you can just stop wondering. I've been told and it's known the Bucs are going with Baker Mayfield week 1 in Minnesota. Everyone, oh, it's not journalism. Ah, you don't know that. Yes, he did know that. We all knew it. That's why. And Baker Mayfield can definitely improve. I mean, he wasn't, you know, Joe Montana or something or anything like that. But just beyond the actual numbers, the intangible stuff, like, he's the guy. Like, that's not, and they were chanting his name in the locker room afterward, and it's not going to be like it was on Sunday all year. I guarantee you I'll be sitting here on this show bitching and moaning several times this year, so will you guys, and, you know, that's coming. It's not like it's, you know, all sunshine and puppies, but that was a really good first game, especially in some adversity when things weren't going really well, to see them turn around the way they did. Was impressive. And I give the Bucs credit. So 1-0 as they take on the Chicago Bears this Sunday. The Bears will be in those alternate uniforms. I am vehemently against any alternate uniforms. Throwbacks are good, but other than that, you should wear your same helmet, your same home and road all the time. The Bears are going to be in orange helmets and orange jerseys, so don't get confused when you get to the game and walk into Raymond James Stadium on Sunday thinking it's the throwback day when you see orange jerseys, because that's the Bears, not the Bucs. The Bucs will be in their white jerseys, as they usually do for the home games in the early part of the season when it's still hot outside. But looking at this matchup on the field, it's a good chance, as we all are saying, for the Bucs to go 2-0. You're at home against an opponent that looked really bad in week 1 and getting trounced by the Packers. And it wasn't Aaron Rodgers in the Packers. It was Jordan Love in the Packers, but it didn't matter, as the Bears never really seemed competitive. Their offense looks as bad as ever. Justin Fields, as a passer at least, doesn't really seem to have it figured out yet, and neither does their offensive coaching or play calling either. But the Bucs are only a 2.5-point favorite in this game. Like, you know, if you look at just the numbers, and it's obviously more than that, but the Bucs didn't exactly light the world on fire on Sunday, especially offensively. But, you know, playing against a team that did even worse, this is basically saying that the two teams are relatively equal on a neutral field, and a small home field advantage, I guess, is the line. Although it was a pick'em before the games in week 1. So if you look at it, though, and all numbers here, because there's some in advanced stats stuff here, it's from Dr. Bob Sports. If you go there, he's got some good numbers and advanced analytics stuff if you're into that sort of thing. But looking at Baker Mayfield against Chicago's secondary, the Bears, at least in week 1, they allowed a 26% big pass rate, and that excludes the garbage time snaps. That was the most in the NFL this past week in week 1. Mike Evans averaged 0.3 EPA per target in week 1. That's good. And he'll have a favorable matchup on Sunday, as he's going to have a rookie, Tyreek Stevenson, going up against him for the Bears. Chris Godwin is going to be across from what looks to be a backup nickelback or their starter, Kyler Gordon. If he plays, he's, you know, a little dinged. And either way, Gordon surrendered almost 2 yards per slot cover snap last year. That ranked him 65th out of 68 qualifying nickelbacks in the NFL last season. So good matchups for Baker, good matchups for Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. Justin Fields, meanwhile, like I said, the Bears offense doesn't look like they know what they want to do with the ball. They dumped the ball a lot. In fact, they led the NFL last week with 16 targets to running backs. Well, in 2022 at least, and this is a bigger sample size, the Bucs defense was 7th in the NFL as far as conceding target yards to running backs. So they do, you know, they can actually rank defenses just based on how much do they allow when the running back's targeted, how much do they allow down the field. The Bucs defense is actually pretty good against conservative offenses like the Bears. And so, you know, we'll see. And Vita Vea has got another decent matchup as Bears center Lucas Patrick gave up 5 pressures in week 1. And so that's a chance for Vita Vea to chow a little bit, hopefully, and really make it a long day for him. We'll see. It's usually, if you know anything about the NFL, if you've watched the NFL as a fan for any amount of time, you know things regress to the mean. So whenever you get up high and you think it's all good, it usually comes back a little bit. And the opposite is true, too. Whenever it's going really bad, it tends to get better. I would actually have preferred had the Bears won last week, honestly, but they didn't look good. They really didn't. And everybody's thinking this is an easy win. I think the Bucs will win, but I would just prepare yourself mentally as a fan right now that it will be hard and that there may be doubt and they may not win. But even if they do, you know, sometimes you come into a game as a fan thinking, oh, let's watch the Bucs game. It's going to go well today. And then you're all frustrated when it's a dogfight. First of all, in the NFL, you can always expect a dogfight. But second of all, we're coming off a huge road win. Everybody's feeling great. They're coming off a horrible home loss. Believe me, those things tend to even out, so keep an eye on that on Sunday. But on paper, yeah, it looks pretty decent for the Bucs. They've got some good matchups there, and the Bears seem like they're a mess. You know, and this is the other thing, turnovers, and they're not totally random. The Bucs earned those, or they earned 2 of the 3 turnovers on Sunday that they got. But, you know, a 3-0 turnover differential is going to win you the football game almost literally every time. So you can't always count on that. But you can take care of the football on your end. That's probably the most you can control about it. The Bucs continue to do that, and Baker Mayfield did that on Sunday, among other things, then they're going to give themselves the best chance to win. Email me if you want to, BobbyGameDay@Yahoo.com. On Twitter, you can get me at BobbyGameDay. As far as league-wide stuff going on, I mean, it was an entertaining week one. Offense around the league was down, by the way. It wasn't just the Bucs or the Vikings, for that matter. So it's a little bit of a thing where, are we looking at an actual signal here? Is there something to any of this? Is it something where maybe there's less to it than we think, more to it than we think? I'm not sure. But if you go into some of the numbers, and I won't slam you with a million numbers here. Week one in the NFL, the average of 41 total points per game, the fewest in any week one since 2017, and the second lowest in 13 years. Dolphins-Chargers was the only game where both teams scored more than 21 points. 2008, 15 years ago, was the last time in Week 1 where only one game had just had two teams scoring more than 21 points. Teams averaged 194.5 net passing yards last week. That's the fewest in Week 1 since 2006, and the fifth lowest in any week of the last 13 seasons. 19 teams failed to reach the 200 net passing yard mark. 4 teams failed to reach 100. The Giants, Falcons, Bengals, and Seahawks. That hadn't happened in week one since 1987. And according to ESPN's QBR metric, where 50 is considered the average, 12 quarterbacks in week one finished with a QBR under 30, an amount that doubles or triples the totals of all week ones from 2019 to 2022. Why is a different question, but there's a few, I mean, you know, you can look at, and there's those numbers I got came from an article on 365scores.com. You know, there's some injuries, obviously Travis Kelce out for the Chiefs, Jerry Jeudy for the Broncos, Rams didn't have Cooper Kupp, even though they won, Christian Watkins out for the Packers, Kyler Murray didn't play for the Cardinals, obviously Aaron Rodgers did start, but only played 4 snaps, and that's a whole other thing. It's hard to say. There was some rain in a few games, maybe something like that. But offense was down all over the league week one. It's a trend to watch. I'm a big apples to apples guy. So, when you're saying, oh, the Bucks offense didn't look good. No, it didn't look great for a while there before it picked up, but neither did anybody else. So let's see if that's a thing or if it's just statistical noise and not really a thing or whatever. We need more of a sample size to see what's going on there. Back to Aaron Rodgers, by the way. I have to say, it was kind of wild seeing all that unfold on Monday night. It ended up being a great game even after Rodgers exited in the punt return overtime winner for the Jets and all that stuff. But as a football fan, whatever you think personally about Aaron Rodgers, just as a football fan, isn't it a little less entertaining now? I didn't want that to happen. Not that I want anybody to ever get hurt. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying in particular, I was interested to see what was going to happen in that game and what was going to happen with the Jets this season and Aaron Rodgers. And the Jets have a good team. The Jets have a really good defense. They have too good of a team not to have a good quarterback, basically. And so Rodgers goes out there, he carries the flag on the field, and then really unfortunate to see the Achilles injury. And now everybody's talking about, is it the turf? Was the MetLife turf to blame? It's taken careers away before, blah, blah. And I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to know. I know there's been a push this week. They're talking about the whole artificial turf thing. Again, they want to see about, or when I say they, the NFLPA and several players have been vocal. They want to see grass on every NFL playing surface. Which, look, we all love, nice natural grass, really nice natural grass fields are the best thing ever, right? Turf beats a bad grass field. But here's the thing about turf. Turf, and there's arguments, the NFL has these numbers saying, oh, the injury rate's not that different. Well, the NFLPA comes back and says, oh, no, well, the way we calculate it, there's tons more injuries on turf. I have no idea if Aaron Rodgers' injury would have happened had that been grass under his left foot instead of turf. I'm not going to pretend I do. But I will say this, and Josh Allen said this week, quote, we've been pushing for this for a long time as players. The way our bodies feel after turf games or after turf practices is significantly different than on grass. That's Josh Allen, word for word quote. The NFL claims other players say, well, they like playing on turf. It's faster, it's crisper, it's cleaner. That's true too. And like I said, I play Ultimate Frisbee. I'm not comparing Ultimate Frisbee to professional football in any way here, okay? But I play Ultimate Frisbee with my buddies every Sunday morning. I've been doing it for 20 years. We play every Sunday. If you ever want to play with us, if you're into it, or if you just want to try it, email me, bobbygameday@yahoo.com. I've had listeners come out before. I'll tell you where we're playing and all that stuff. But usually we play on grass, but every once in a while we play on turf football fields. And just like they're saying, as I'm playing on it, as the game's going on, and Ultimate Frisbee, you're not getting hit or tackled onto the turf, obviously, but you are running and pounding. It's a lot like basketball, lots of quick cuts, lots of pounding your legs into it. As I'm playing on turf, I love it. It is. It's fast. It's clean. It's crisp. There's nothing, it's just perfect. And again, perfect grass is better than turf, but the grass we play on is not turf, or not perfect turf. So we play on it sometimes, and it's great when we're playing on it. On Monday morning, after we play on turf, my legs are really a lot more sore. I don't notice it when it's happening. It's not like it feels different, I'm running around going, ow, this hurts. But on Monday morning when I play on grass, I'm still a little bit sore. But on Mondays after we play on turf, I really feel a difference. And I'm like, damn, what happened? I have to stop and think, oh, we played on turf yesterday. So I get that part, and that's without being tackled on it. It's just harder. It's harder than grass. And the other thing about it is it's got better traction than grass. So a lot of these injuries aren't because, turf is some boogeyman or, oh, my God, the turf's going to jump up and blow out your ACL. It's just that when you put tons of pressure on your foot stays there in turf. Your foot is staying there, and you put that extra stress on the tendons or ligament or whatever it is, and there's more tear. I don't know. Again, the research, depending on who you talk to, can vary. But when there are injuries on turf, that's usually why. Because you stick a foot in the ground, in any sport, it's the any field sport, the essence of it is sticking your foot in the ground, exerting force, and pushing your body a certain direction, opposite of the way you're pushing your foot, right? So sometimes things get tangled, sometimes weight comes down a funny way, sometimes guys are on top of you in football. And yeah, on turf, your foot's going to stay put. It's a good thing when you're running around. But then sometimes when you want it to give and you'd rather fall down and it doesn't, that's where you get some of these injuries. But looking at it from like MetLife Stadium, You want to put grass at MetLife Stadium. Didn't they have like two nights in a row they had a game? They had the Giants on Sunday Night Football against the Cowboys, and although most of us turned that off after the first quarter. And then they had the Monday Night Football game with the Jets and the Bills. Okay. And then after that, they had like, or 2 days before that, they had a concert. I mean, it just feels like that. It's hard to have grass. It would get destroyed. Never mind the dome stadiums, where obviously you'd have to come up with some sort of solution, or just 8 times a year do that temporary grass thing like they do for the World Cup. So people say, oh, well, the NFL's got billions of dollars. Figure it out. Yeah, maybe they will, but it's not very practical for a lot of stadiums. We're here at Raymond James, it's fine. We're down here in Margaritaville. It's beautiful, and you can grow grass, and the grass, even with USF playing the day before, it's not usually that bad, and they don't have that many back-to-back days, and we don't have a million concerts and stuff like that. We had Taylor Swift, and we had Beyonce, but it's not a regular occurrence during football season, and Monster Jam is a different time of year, so fine. For us, you know, Miami, whoever, no big deal, but I don't know if there's going to be grass on every single NFL field anytime soon. Just something I thought was worth mentioning and keeping an eye on. But the beautiful turf at Raymond James Stadium will be occupied on Sunday, 1 o'clock, Bucks versus Bears. And all week long, you can keep it right here on JoeBucksFan.com, the single best place anywhere for Bucks coverage. All you have to do is refresh the page, because there's always new stuff up there. So thanks to the Joes for giving me the platform. I appreciate it as always. It's an honor and a privilege. Thanks to you guys for listening. Email me if you want to. BobbyGameDay@yahoo.com if you have a question about the Bucks, a comment, or you want to play Frisbee or whatever. On Twitter, you can get me at BobbyGameDay. I still have the fridge schedule. If anybody wants a fridge schedule, I'll email it to you. Have a great weekend. Be safe. If you're going to the game, have fun, tailgating, whatever. If you're staying home, have some friends and family over. Make it an event. Make it a reason to get together with people you like spending time with. But no matter what you do, have fun, and I'll talk to you next week, hopefully about a 2-0 football team. In the meantime, thank you for giving me your time. I'll be back next week, and wherever you are, good morning, good afternoon, good night, and go Bucks.